It Was Almost Real, the Pro Wrestling History Podcast, episode number 50. Hello, everyone, and welcome to It Was Almost Real, the Pro Wrestling History Podcast. And this is the podcast dedicated to professional wrestling history from 1870 to 1920. Joining me on the podcast this week is Dangerous Dan, continuing on the road to recovery. He's almost off the injured reserve. And we're also joined in the studio by my oldest son, Trey. We tried to get all four of us together for episode 50, but unfortunately, my youngest son had to work today, so we're doing the best that we can. But we've got great news before we get too deep into the podcast. We're recording this on Sunday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, and my great-nephew Jameson was born this morning. We want to congratulate Kevin and Sammy and welcome Jameson into the family. You're family member number 80, 83, somewhere in there, bud. So welcome. Don't everybody just jump in here at once.
I just realized they had their kid was born on St. Patrick's Day and they named it Jameson, which is also the name of an Irish whiskey. And that is just a hilarious coincidence to me.
Yeah.
So the kid's gonna be tough as hell whenever he grows up, because
yeah, probably. We got a couple of things to discuss today, a few updates and that before we jump into the history. A number of things have been happening, but anything you two want to bring? I know Dan might be chomping at the bit since he's been stuck inside watching probably more TV than he has in quite a while. Anything you guys want to cover before we get into any updates?
I don't think I have anything too major, so.
No, I was the only thing that got me is how often the WCW would reuse gimmicks over and over and over. And the customer still ate it up.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you said that, Dan. I went back and watched Starrcade, the highlights, over the last couple weeks. And, you know, after Crockett sold to Turner, WCW was not what it was, you know, from that point forward. I thought there was a transition. That transition was less than a year. 89 was pretty good, particularly when you had Steamboat come back and you had those high quality matches with Steamboat and Flair. But by 1990, it was pretty bad and it never fully recovered. You had that interesting portion in the mid 90s where Hall and Nash came over and they did the whole outsider angle.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, that show was pretty bad from 1990 on.
Yeah, it never did. It never did pick up the steam that it had.
And it went down quick. I mean, you watch Starrcade from 91 to 92, you're like, oh my goodness, this was so bad. But the funny thing was, they were beating Vince for a couple of years pretty soundly. Yeah. Well, a couple of the updates. So, as I had said in the past, I was going to work on two books at the same time, which I'm doing. I'm trying to finish the St. Louis history book on Chief of Detectives William Desmond. And I'm also working on a new book on John the Nebraska Tigerman Pesek, who settled several promotional wars in the 1920s. And I went over some of those in the last podcast. And as every time I start on one of these research projects, I always unlearn something I always thought I knew. I discovered early on in this project, even though Landis really hit his zenith in St. Louis and became a really big name in professional wrestling once he hooked up with Tom Pax, he was already starting to develop a little bit of a national reputation in the late teens, and he was going by Jim Landis as early as 1917. I thought that he didn't start going by Landis until 1919, 1920, but he actually, in 1917, he's going by Jim Landis. And that's the match we're going to review today, is one I found from 1933. But Jim Landis is not only the biggest box office star of the 1930s, He's the biggest box office star of professional wrestling ever. He was drawing 30,000 fans to baseball stadiums in this country and 70 to 100,000 fans in soccer stadiums, football, and the rest of the world. And Greece, when he went back to Greece in 1933, and the match we're going to talk about today is Landis versus Kola Quariani.
Yeah.
But before we got into that, I told you, and you told me that you're not going to let me do podcasts on my own anymore. I told you that I had commended Tony Khan for, one, the way that the Sting match went off, or the Sting retirement was carried out. I thought that it was a good way for Sting to go out, and they did that as well as they can do anything. And I also commended him for suspending Sammy Guevara from doing that loop-de-loo and landing on Jeff Hardy's face with his shin, and then going ahead and doing the finish anyway once they told him to go home and just pin him. So I thought those were both good things. One thing I wanted to talk about that I forgot to tell you, I already know my answer. I'm sure I know your answer too. The next AEW pay-per-view is going to be from St. Louis in April. My feeling is I don't have 7 hours of my life to dedicate to a pay-per-view, nor do I want to watch, you know, 4 hours of Drek for a few pearls here and there.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming you feel the same way, Dan. I'm going to take that as a yes.
I feel the same way, but yet I would. One of these times, I would like to see the spectacle and the pageantry.
I would too, because I don't think we can fairly judge it just by watching it on TV or seeing clips. I really would like to attend a show. It's just, I wish they would have a show that was like 3 hours, you know. Even 4 hours, you know, I could get a little late too, or I could leave a little early. I'm going to commend Tony again, and you're probably going to be like, what? But he just signed Will Ospreay, and I think that's a good signing for their company. Because he is the smart fan darling right now. And if you're not going to try to expand your audience, you should definitely try to keep the audience you have. And with 700,000 to 800,000 people consistently tuning in to watch your show every week, I think you can have a viable company. I just wish they would try to be profitable. Running smaller venues is definitely a better idea. And if they could just get rid of some of the people that they never, ever use, you know, I don't like to see. One of the reasons I want Tony to succeed is I want wrestlers to have options about where they go, where they wrestle. It'd be great if Tony's company survived more than a few years.
But, and that's what I'm saying. You need to get rid of half of this lineup where you're paying them $50 a week to sit at home.
Yeah, because you're never going to be profitable if you've got a huge group of people that you can't use.
Exactly. And
when he does try to use them, you're pushing people out that you should be pushing to make room for people that you're never, ever using.
Right, absolutely.
So, yeah, I definitely like to see him do that to be more profitable, you know, to be a much more viable company. So, speaking of companies, I would not have known this because I don't really watch the news that often anymore. But Trey and Caleb clued me into this new scheme. And I think they've already walked it back. Trey can tell me if that's true or not. But Wendy's came up with the great idea a couple of weeks ago that they were going to go to surge pricing. And if you were in the dark about this as I was, surge pricing means that if you go into the restaurant to get your food at the normal times that people eat lunch or dinner, that the algorithm was going to detect that that was a high volume time and you were going to pay more for your food than if you came at a different time where, you know, nobody's eating. Well, you might surge me once, but you ain't going to surge me twice. And if you surge me once, I'm going to surge myself right on out of that restaurant and never ever come back. So did they walk that back, Trey?
Yeah, because people online made a huge stink about it and boycotted it. We've been boycotting that Kellogg's because of what their CEO was saying about how you should just have cereal for dinner. You know, it's totally not going to give you diabetes or anything. It's totally just absolutely healthy dinner for you right there. And McDonald's was apparently getting close to having like $18 Big Macs. And oh, wow. All three of those companies are suffering because of boycotts right now. And they Wendy's walked that back. I don't know if people are going back. Personally, I'm like, if they do that, you gotta keep boycotting for a few months just to send them a message. But
so puff sugar and air is a great breakfast or a great dinner.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm glad they walked that back. I have a theory because Dave, the founder of Wendy's, had a definite vision and made that restaurant chain work.
Yeah.
But you see it with Sam Walton. I've seen it with Jeff Bezos. When you get someone who is kind of a visionary and an outlier and they turn their company into something special, when that person dies off, they retire, they go do something else, and the lawyers and the accountants take over, it becomes just another poorly run, bad idea company. What made that company special a lot of time goes away if you don't have someone with that same vision to take the reins from the founder of that company.
And that's also part of the problem is they have so much of a nest egg right now. They can suffer being idiots for several years and that business just won't go away. So, and there's not really a whole lot of other alternatives if we're talking about like I think with cereal you have to go to General Mills, which is Nestle, and Nestle is all kinds of horrible. As far as fast food goes, you have a few different burger places, but also it's like Burger King, McDonald's, Steak and Shake is pretty good all things considered, but your options are pretty limited on what all you can go to.
Well, none of it's particularly healthy, so just eat it in small doses anyway if you want to be healthy.
Yeah, and it's overpriced for what it is. I was joking around with the guys in my work group and my gaming group. I basically made do-it-yourself Taco Bell. I made like 8 quesadillas for probably $10.
Good.
Yeah, no. So I basically had like lunches for several days, and I told them, I'm like, I made these for like $1.40 a quesadilla. And it's the exact same recipe as Taco Bell. I even have the Taco Bell Chipotle sauce. Wow. But it's just so much cheaper because I actually made it myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, when Trey was talking about people can be idiots for a while, I remember a quote from Gary Hart, Dan. Repetition is the key when you're dealing with goofs.
Oh, there you go.
Gary Hart had quite a way with words.
Yeah,
he had quite a way with a lot of things.
And our history topic today, we're actually going to talk a little bit about how things going on in the world affect wrestling, because wrestling or any other thing, nothing occurs in a vacuum. So, yes, sir.
Right before we get into this, I did have a question from earlier.
Yeah.
How lucrative was a territory, successful territory, back in the day?
Well, I'm going to steal a quote from Jim Cornette because he said it many times and it's really true. It was a license to print money. So when you had a successful territory in the NWA era, so say from 1948 on.
Yeah.
One, because they were all cooperating with each other. Now, realize these are not a bunch of guys sitting around holding hands singing Kumbaya. Yeah. You know, they would stab each other in the back in a heartbeat if it would get them a little bit more money. But because they agreed to stay out of each other's territory for the most part.
Yeah.
Those successful territories, it was a consistent money-making business. When you knew what you were doing and you could put on a wrestling show that would, so if you're in Tennessee, mm-hmm. You're in Memphis every single Monday, I think it was. And each one of those towns is a weekly town. So you're talking 52 shows a year. And say on average, you draw 7,000 to 8,000 fans of those shows every single week. Think of how much money those shows are pulling in, even if you're only charging $4, $5, and $6 a ticket.
Right.
To get that 8,000 in there every single week for 52 weeks. Sam Muchnick had a very prosperous territory, running cards every 3 weeks down at the Keel. He had basically a little bit more than a monthly territory, and it was a lucrative promotion.
Yeah.
Now, Sam also made money as NWA president and booking out the world champion, but it was still a lucrative enough territory to pull in the big names from all around the country
as
sort of an all-star promotion. And I know St. Louis consistently drew 9,000 fans to the Keel for their cards. When territories were down, well, yeah, like any other business, you would really be hurting. But you had to work at it. And, I mean, we saw it ourselves in our lifetime. Sam Muchnick had a successful promotion for 40-plus years. He sold it and retired, and within 6 months, the people that took it over from him, because they were booking Central States, which was like the B film studios, so like a Monogram Pictures
and
professional wrestling, they tried to run St. Louis that same way, and it did not work. It went down the tubes very, very quickly. And Dan, you just triggered my mind about something else in wrestling. You know, we always say repetition is the key with dealing with Goose, but a lot of times in wrestling, things that work, you were just talking about how WCW would use the same things over and over. Somebody had reached out to me on Twitter because I've been writing about Ed Strangler Lewis, and they didn't know about Evan Strangler Lewis.
Oh. And,
but because it's Sergey, the wrestling nerd, on Twitter. He was pointing out how, you know, they reuse things like you had Sorokichi Matsuda, and then you had other Japanese wrestlers take versions of that name. You know, you had so many Valentines in wrestling and all of that. That goes back to the very beginning. If there has been a successful gimmick, people tend to repeat it. So Evan Strangler Lewis, not only did Ed Strangler Lewis take the name, but there was a Martin Strangler Lewis who claimed to be related to Evan, who wasn't. And then there was a young Strangler Lewis.
Yeah.
And so you have this, you know, throughout history, you have people, you know, Carl Gotch, as Sergey pointed out, Carl Gotch taking his name in homage to Frank Gotch. You know, when those things have been successful, they tend to repeat it. So the first big Samoan wrestler was Nef Maiava. Well, when Peter Maivia came up, they gave him, they meant to give him the same name, but they didn't know how Maiava was spelled. So what they thought was going to be Peter Maiava became Peter Maivia. And you know, you have Nef Maiava.
Yeah. But
there tends to be repetition when something works. Why mess around with it? So if a wrestler came along and looked like someone, a lot of times they would be given a similar name or, you know, a similar gimmick.
There
was something prescient that you pointed out a little bit ago, that people, the promoters and the bookers, tended to repeat things that had worked. And bookers, a lot of times when they switch territories, they would bring things that worked in their other territory with them, but they might twist it just a little bit to fit the tastes of their crowd. Because you and I have talked about, the Sheik was never going to get over in Sam Muchnick's St. Louis, nor Abdullah the Butcher. Sam didn't want that kind of heat, and the fans were not trained for that kind of wrestling.
That was ECW before ECW was popular.
And ECW doesn't hold up today. Go back and try to watch it. It does not hold up.
Oh, no, not at all.
Okay, so do we want to get into some history?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, sure.
Trey looks like he's about to fall asleep over there. And maybe he'll fall asleep after listening to this. I've been researching this book on John Pesek. And as I say, I always unlearn and learn new things. One thing that I did know, and that this research project so far has borne out, is that when World War One started, well, not started, but when America got involved in World War One, which was pretty late in the game in around 1917,
yeah,
that definitely had effect on professional wrestling and staging cards. Because one, a lot of the wrestlers went into the military.
Yes, they did. So
even if they were not posted outside of the United States, they were in the military. So Earl Caddock went into the Army, and he was actually stationed in Europe. He won the world championship in 1917. And basically, they tried to do something where they created like an interim title, like they'll do in UFC or sometimes even in wrestling. They tried to create an interim championship. But Caddock was the world champion, and he was serving overseas. So you really didn't have a true legitimate world title match until he came back from overseas in 1919 and 1920. You also had Joe Stecker went into the Navy, and that affected his ability to wrestle in certain matches. You had John the Nebraska Tiger Man Pesek and his manager were both drafted in the Army. However, they did not end up leaving the States, and they were able to wrestle occasional matches with permission from the Army. I don't think Ed Strangler Lewis went into the service, so he was not affected. And Władek Zbyszko, who was Polish, and I don't believe had applied for citizenship yet, didn't go into the service either. So he was here and available to wrestle. It affected the ability to put on cards. There weren't a lot of wrestlers around. And because the war effort took a priority, all the resources in that went to the military effort first and civilian things second. In 1919, John the Nebraska Tiger Man Pesek found himself pretty much in the same position as Marin Plastina, who had been campaigning for a legitimate contest with Stecker first and then with Caddock. And he was on the outs with the big wrestling trust at the time that was controlled by Jack Curley up in New York.
Right.
Pesek was pretty much in the same position because, like Plastina, Pesek did not like to work. And as a matter of fact, in the first 3-4 years of his career that I'm covering, and I'm mainly focused on the big matches after the first or second year, I only find him working one of them. Starting in 1920, though, he does start getting matches with members of the Trust, Stecker and Caddock, and it looks like he's working these matches with those guys. But initially, he didn't want to work matches. He wanted to wrestle contests. And because he was good, he was both a shooter and a hooker. Because he was good, they didn't want to put him in the ring with those guys. He would not have gotten this match that I'm getting ready to talk about, with the exception of World War One came about. Curley did not have opponent for Władek Zbyszko. This match would not have occurred if it had not been for World War One, because Jack Curley in New York was desperate enough to have some kind of income coming in. He had Władek Zbyszko, and he didn't have an opponent for him. He could have booked him against Lewis, but they hated each other and used to get into fist fights all the time. So he probably thought that wasn't the best idea. So he agrees to accept the challenge of John the Nebraska Tiger Man Pesek. So Pesek, like Plastina, had been challenging the Big Four for a couple of years. The Big Four was world champion Earl Caddock, former world champion Joe Stecker, who Caddock had defeated, Ed Strangler Lewis, and Władek Zbyszko. Curley agrees for a match.
Pretty formidable team right there.
Do what?
I said that's a pretty formidable team right there.
Yeah, well, those four guys were dominating wrestling in the late teens, and that's why they called them the Big Four, and that's why Pesek wanted a match with one of them. So Curley is desperate enough, because he can't get wrestlers to hold a card, that he accepts a match in Nebraska because Pesek had not left Nebraska at this time. He accepts a match in Nebraska contest with Pesek for Zbyszko. I think that they thought, even though Pesek was pretty well regarded, that a guy that had only been wrestling for 4 years and had never left Nebraska was not going to be able to beat Zbyszko.
Right.
They wrestle in, is it Gideon, Nebraska? It's a very, very small town, but the town, which is normally about 1,500 people, is artificially boosted for this match.
Oh, wow.
Because the Stockmen's Association is having their annual convention in town that week, and that's why they're having the match there. So
gotcha.
There was between 4,000 and 5,000 people that came out to see this match because they held it during the Stockmen's convention. The match goes about 2.5 hours, and Pesek wins the legitimate contest with Zbyszko. However, they all made a lot of money off of it, and this is probably why Curly eventually lets Pesek wrestle people in the trust, because he's seen how much money Pesek can draw in Nebraska, and he figures it's only a matter of time before his reputation gets big enough that he can draw that kind of money in Des Moines, in Chicago, and then eventually New York, which Pesek is able to do all of that. Had it not been for World War I, and had it not been for how hard it was to get a match for Zbyszko, Curly would have never come to Nebraska and never would have risked Zbyszko against him. And it was obviously a losing gambit because Pesek defeated him legitimately.
Yeah.
Curly is still not convinced, though, after that one victory, to let Pesek in with the members of the trust, particularly now that he's seen what a capable shooter he is. Although Curly going to Nebraska in 1918 with Zbyszko is probably the reason Curly and the rest of the members of the trust picked Pesek to wrestle Marin Plastina in that legitimate contest to end the promotional war in 1921. Jim Landis, I told you, is already starting to get a little bit of a reputation. Well, he had, the only match I know of Pesek working in the first 4 years of his career was actually with Landis. It could have been a gambling scheme, but over $2,000 changed hands in bets during the match between Landis and Pesek. Pesek and Landis had already wrestled once and worked. But in this match in 1919, Curly had promised Pesek and his manager, Martin Slattery, that if they could beat Landis in a contest, then they would match him up against one of the big four. So they agreed to the match. It was a best 2 out of 3 falls catch wrestling match. This one went almost 2.5 hours. Pesek won again. He won the first fall with a hold, and he won the second fall when Landis's manager threw in the towel. I've said before, Landis was a shooter and a hooker. He had learned how to hook from the carnival wrestlers that taught him when he was a carnival strongman. But he was never on the level of Pesek as a shooter and a hooker, even this early in Pesek's career. Pesek had been taught by Clarence Eklund, who was a smaller wrestler, but knew hooking and shooting. And that's how he learned. And he was also very strong because he was a farmer. He stayed in Nebraska because he was farming and had a successful farm the whole time he was wrestling professionally, which was not all that uncommon in this era. It was not uncommon for professional wrestlers, even bigger stars, to have farms or other side businesses and interests. Well, in modern day, we know Ole Anderson owned a sawmill. After he did defeat Landis, I expected, well, they probably didn't follow through. They actually did. He did get a match with Stecker, and he did get a match with Kadek. And then eventually he would be their representative against Marin Plastina. So continuing to learn interesting things in this research project, that's hardly all of it, but I just wanted to touch on how sometimes circumstances outside of the business affect things that actually make things occur within the business.
Yeah.
Okay.
I see that.
I know we've got our review coming up. I know you only saw about half of it, Dan. What you saw was Landis demonstrating the wrestling in that. And I was telling Trey, because Landis has got a pretty good physique. He was 37 years old at the time of that match in 1933. Because he got a start in wrestling later, he was an older guy as world champion. I think a lot of people see most of the film footage out there. Most of the film footage out there, he's already in his 40s. There's only a few matches from the early 30s. Most of it is 38 on. There's even a match out there from 1950 where he's wrestling Primo Carnera, where he's in his mid-50s. But he always kept himself in great shape. But the reason I looked at that match was because of the huge crowd that it drew to that soccer stadium. What do you think, Trey? Do you think it was closer to 100,000 or 70,000?
It's hard to tell because like we only saw about like a third of it. I think in that pan shot they did. It wouldn't shock me if it was closer to 100. Could have gone a little bit past that even, but
there were a lot of people.
It was a lot. It was like packed seat, or they were packed seat to seat.
Yeah.
In the, there wasn't like any gaps or anything between too many people, so.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty impressive. And he was doing some training with some guys. And I mean, he was kind of playing around with them, but it showed him training. And then, I mean, you just get a few brief highlights from the match with Cola Quariani. I'm sure that match itself probably went an hour or two, but you only see the highlights of Landis pinning him in that. I thought it was, we tend to think of, oh, these huge crowds are a modern thing. You know, Vince McMahon took it out of the smoke-filled arenas. No, there were huge crowds being drawn going back. I mean, the second Gotch Hackenschmidt bout drew 30,000 plus fans. I think it was 35 altogether to Comiskey Park in 1911. So, you know, selling out the Pontiac Silverdome, that wasn't the first stadium sellout. What won't be the last.
Yeah,
but because I think the thing with Vince is like, did it consistently fill out the arena? Whereas these seem like special occasions where it fills out. Maybe there's like special events that Vince did. Like,
yes, that was a special event in Greece, but AEW just sold out Wembley Stadium, and that's because that was a special event.
Right.
Nobody had been. I mean, they sold that out before they even announced the card. So that was people just wanted to see wrestling that hadn't seen wrestling in a very long time. But Vince didn't do Pontiac Silverdome every time. He had a couple huge sellouts. Toronto was one. You know, he's had a couple huge ones. Landis sold out. Well, didn't sell out because they held more than that. But he would fill, you know, baseball parks with 30,000 plus spectators in the 30s here. So he pretty consistently drew very large crowds.
Okay.
And Landis had a good physique and he was a good looking guy. So that's why he attracted so many fans in that. He was one of the early baby faces.
Right.
Now, if you listen to Ed Strangler Lewis, he wasn't a baby face outside of the ring, but inside of the ring, he was a baby face.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ed Strangler Lewis was not fond of Landis. Marcus Griffin alleges in The Fall Guys that Londis took part in a lot of gambling schemes over the years, which is possible. Well, it's not only possible, it's probable. But a lot of the guys were doing that. So it's, and Griffin wanted to paint pro wrestling in a very bad light and the wrestlers in a very bad light because he had been a member of the Buffalo promotional office who had been fired. And he did have a journalism background. That's what he was doing before they hired him to be their public relations man. So he wrote that book, The Fall Guys, to try to get back at some of the promoters and that he had thought had done him wrong. So you can't take things that you see in that book at face value without doing a little cross-checking of facts and things before you go with things. And so Londis is not painted in a very favorable light in that book, The Fall Guys, because of the gambling schemes and some other things. But you can't just take that at face value. I don't know that Londis was any worse or any better than anybody else that was wrestling at the time. As we talked about a few weeks ago, wrestling has always been a bit of a dirty business. It doesn't always attract, you know, your most solid citizens to the promotional or the wrestler ranks. So I don't want to paint everybody with a broad brush that they were bad guys. You see a lot of questionable behavior in wrestling over the years. And you've got the American heavyweight wrestling champion pulling a gambling scheme on a small town up in Minnesota. You know, pro wrestling has a sordid reputation for a reason.
Yeah.
I think people would know a lot more about Londis if there was more film of him. Mm-hmm. And the film we do have is of him, like I said, when he's in his 40s up to his 50s. It's why so many of the stars today, I'm not stars today, the stars of yesteryear are not thought of as well. Because if you didn't see him in your prime, we've talked many times. Yeah. If you did not see Junkyard Dog in Mid-South from 80 to 82 or 79 to 82.
Right.
If all you saw was him in the WWF, you would probably be like, what's all this about the Junkyard Dog?
Yeah.
But if you saw him in his prime in Louisiana, same thing with Hacksaw Jim Duggan, you're like, oh, now I get it.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't necessarily get it. It's like only seeing late Ric Flair. Not seeing Ric Flair when he was at his peak in the early to mid late 80s. I mean, right. Flair was great even up into 89 when he was 40 years old. So,
yeah. But then did he go downhill?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Father Time catches us all. Nobody escapes that. And it's one of the things that drives me crazy about this You Still Got It chant. Most of the time, the people they're chanting that to don't still have it. You probably should have called it a career a little while ago. Because the style today, I think that back when you and I started watching in the 70s and the 80s, there was so little high flying and all of that. Mm-hmm. You could have a credible match if you kept yourself in good shape. Maybe into your late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Into your 50s is pushing it.
Yeah.
Because everybody will chant, You Still Got It, but they don't. You know?
Yeah.
And The Rock is going to get involved in somehow. He's going to have these tag matches and all that. And I'm sure people will probably chant, You Still Got It.
Why did he even come back? Because wasn't he doing okay as an actor for like these action movies and crap?
He was, but number one, there was the writer's strike. So remember what we were talking about earlier, that things that happen outside of wrestling sometimes have an effect within wrestling?
Yeah.
So the first thing that happened was that his acting career was put on hold for about 6 months to a year because when the writers went on strike, there are no productions going on. So he has no movies or TV shows to work on because of the writer's strike. Number two, he got involved and bought the XFL and the USFL and merged the two of them into this new spring football league. And so publicity for that helps too. Number three, they've been wanting to have this match between him and Roman Reigns where he'll put Reigns over and kind of anoint him. It's never worked out from a timing standpoint, but now all of a sudden it did work out. And they wanted him to be on the board of directors too. So it all kind of dovetailed into, oh, this works. So from a timing standpoint, it worked out for him. He's 52 years old. And yeah, he looks great. He's still 52 years old. He's not going to be what he was 20 years ago. And more than likely, the Seth and Cody are going to have to slow up for him. Just like if he wrestled Roman, Roman would have to slow up for him. You know, that's when people tend to get hurt.
Right.
So I'm sure people are going to listen to this podcast and say, Undertaker was great in his 50s. This person was great in their 50s. No, they were passably believable in their 50s. They weren't great. They were great in their 30s. They weren't great in their 50s. You know, mentally, you're probably sharper. In many ways, wisdom, and that you're much sharper. You're not what you were when you were 30. I'm someone who's kept myself in great shape, and I've been able to hang with my students, but I'm not what I was when I was 35.
Yeah.
And so whenever I hear people go, you still got it, I want to say, no, they don't.
Yeah.
I think we covered just about everything. The next episode is probably going to be a solo episode, and then we should be back to normal with the recordings session and everything. Well, back in the studio. I don't dislike this Skype method because it does allow us to be all together. But I have to admit, I like being in the $1 million studio better than I like being on Skype.
Yeah.
It's just a little disjointed.
Right. Because it's kind of hard to tell what everybody is really. Because when you can get their physical reaction, it's a lot easier to read the room and figure out who's trying to respond, whatever. But
yeah, and I spend a lot. I tend to do almost all the talking when we're doing the Skype session. So,
in my defense, I really only have like certain things that I would even need to comment on, like that are because I don't know too much about wrestling, other than like from video games. But that's all right.
I think that's going to be it for this week. We will see everyone next week, which will be, oh my goodness, Monday, April Fool's Day. Boy, that would be a good time to get all four of us together. But if all four of us are going to be on Skype, I think I'm just going to do a solo episode. I've been a fool to myself for many years, so I can continue that tradition. And then hopefully we can get back to the $1 million studio here in the next couple of weeks. With that, everybody, you like the podcast, please leave us a rating and a review on your where you listen to us at. That helps people discover us. And until next time, take care, everybody. Bye-bye.